guys, what's up? This is Sarah Troutman, and you might notice that we have a new name. It's Defy. So why did we change the podcast title? We changed the podcast title because when I was talking to the team of incredible individuals that I work with, we realized we don't care about fitting into societal or professional norms. We defy them. And that's really been the theme of all of the guests that we've had on this podcast. So why don't we just call a spade? And that's what we're all about, defy. Is this a show about perfection? Nah, because that doesn't exist. Is this a show full of empty self-help quotes for you to put on your Instagram? Hell no, that ain't our style. This is a show about defying the norms because well-behaved women rarely make history. So come on, babe, come defy with us and learn how you can use the power of behavioral science to live an amazing life. Come on, skinny love, what happened here? Nicole, this is like the first official Defy podcast of 2021. You should feel very special right now.
It's crazy.
I know.
I feel very special.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm super stoked. And you know, so right now let's set the stage. You and I usually live like 10 minutes away from each other. Yeah.
Yeah.
10 minutes, maybe, but not right now because I have escaped the horror of the Bay Area and I am currently in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I have to say it is quite lovely and a welcome change of pace from the very sad and depressing Bay Area, not to make you like feel bad.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
It's freezing here. So if it's, yeah,
well, I mean, but let me be honest, like this is the desert and it's January in Arizona. So this morning I woke up and I went outside. It was a crisp 41. It was a crisp 41, but the high today will still be about 72. And there's lots of fun like cactus and, you know, other things to enjoy in the outdoors of the greater Phoenix area.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm at. And you are in Oakland, California. And this is our first podcast and I'm super excited. Or, well, 2021, like not first podcast ever, obviously. And you are one of our newer team members at Defy, and where you are different than most of our other team members, with the exception of Anna, who does all of our marketing, is you aren't coming from a behavior analytic background. That has not been your focus and what you've done in your career. But we reached out to you because you have this incredible skill and are even certified in yoga instruction. And we're going to be starting to offer classes for Defy members that you are going to be teaching. They're actually going to start, we're recording this, what day is it today? January 5th.
Yep.
Your classes are starting tomorrow, January 6th. This episode won't air until tomorrow. Next week. But this is, you know, something that we're really excited about. But I wanted to bring you on the podcast, not to talk about like, hey, you're an amazing yoga instructor and everyone should take your classes, but to really talk about how you got to become a yoga instructor, because it's actually a really good story. So in order for us to tell the story, we need to go way back into time. And we're going to start, you're a Bay Area native and people need to understand that, like, rolling deep. But there was a major life event that happened for you when you were about 8 years old. And that was that your family moved from San Leandro, which is, for people that know the Bay, is just like a little south of Oakland. So San Leandro is a very diverse city, same with Oakland, and one of the most diverse areas in the country, actually. And your family moved to the lovely little suburban hamlet of Danville. It was a Danville or San Ramon, because those are like boarding. Was it Danville?
Danville.
Okay.
Yeah.
So to provide some context, I've always referred to like Danville and San Ramon as the Orange County of the North. So, you know, think of it as like a lot of money, like nice subdivisions. And, you know, at that time when you moved up there, not a lot of diversity. And this matters for a very specific reason. And that is because you are Chinese American. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about, you know, your family's background, what you guys were doing in San Leandro and why you made this move and really how that had a really huge impact on you.
Yeah, absolutely. So my dad was born in China, in Canton, and, you know, he came over here probably around high school, middle school, high school. And he grew up in San Francisco. They did have some property in Oakland, Chinatown. And then coincidentally, my mom grew up very close to where I live now. I actually run by her old house all the time. So she grew up in Piedmont in Oakland. Reason why they decided to move to San Leandro, it made sense. All of their family is here. My dad's family, most of them are in the city. And then most of my mom's family, they're now in Danville. At the time, they were in Alameda and like surrounding areas to her. My grandpa was in Oakland. So it all made sense. Very diverse growing up. I don't think I noticed it until I actually made the move to Danville. The reason why my parents decided to move was because, you know, my brother and sister were born. They're 18 months apart. It was like, bam, bam. My brother was unexpected. And they were like, wow, we need a bigger house. We need to look into, you know, the best school districts. And they did it for us. So they made the move. And definitely a change in pace. I think I mentioned to you last time, Sarah, that, you know, I used to wait in line and play tetherball at my elementary school. And it was just like, it was just this thing, right? You like waited in these long lines. You got to play with the older kids. You got down and dirty. People are like yelling. It's like so cool. And like, that was my comfort. I was like, okay, so I'm going to go to this new school. I don't know anybody. It actually was the first year of this school, Sycamore Valley, for any of you guys who know the school in Danville. And I was so excited to just get out there during recess and play some tetherball and meet new friends. And it was going to be so cool. And there was nobody. It was like crickets.
Yeah.
People were like off in their little like quiet groups, like, you know, by the play structures. And so, I mean, that was one of my earlier memories of first starting school in Danville. However, I will also say at the time, you know, it's a long time ago. So my parents were able to pick out, you know, a plot of land and watch their home be built from the ground up. And so that was really cool being able to, you know, go see my house like as a plot of land and then watch it kind of be built ground up. It was really exciting for me. And that was, you know, those are the only two places I've lived. And so growing up, it was like, oh, we go house shopping. We're going to go to open houses. That was really fun. You know, this is just what you do. You go to school, you graduate, you buy a house. Like it was very quintessential. Like,
yeah, it's like the American dream. And I think that there are so many families.
Yeah.
You know, especially families that are immigrant families that are just like, this is exactly, you know, this is the promise of America. This is why we relocated here, you know, and especially for families that have like deep value in education, you know, like, of course, we're going to move to like the district with like the good schools. But I think, you know, because you're younger than me. And so, but there's still like when you were in Danville growing up, it was what, like the late 80s, early 90s. People just didn't talk as much about what it meant 90s. To feel like you had to assimilate. And to feel like you had to, especially if you are were a person of, you know, a minority, you know, or of immigrant status or or both, I think sometimes parents didn't think about the toll that that might take on their kids because they're thinking, hey, I'm just giving, you know, I want to, you know, we can afford to live in this great place. You have this great education. Like, what else is there? But like when we were talking, when we were planning this podcast episode, I asked you specifically, I was like, hey, did you have kids say any like weird, like racist stuff to you when you were there? Cause now like Danville's much more diverse. But again, like when you guys first moved there, that was not the case. And you said that there was actually a story about a kid commenting about your nose. Can you tell everybody? Cause it was just like, what?
Yeah. I have to share it with everyone. And it was actually a boy that I had a crush on. A lot of my friends probably know who this is, but this was in elementary school and we were both waiting for our parents after school to pick us up and, you know, whatever talking. And then he was like, you look like you got run over by a car because your nose is so flat. And it wasn't like really, it was like, I don't even know if it was like in a really like joking way either. It was just kind of like a statement. And I was like, okay, like I just took it and rolled with it. And that was that. But I've remembered that for years. you know, and so little, there were little micro racisms like across, you know, the span of many years, but again, just trying so hard to assimilate into this new place. I just let a lot of it just kind of roll off my back and pretend like it didn't matter. I wanted so much to be like everybody else. And even to the point, Sarah, of, you know, I think for a while, and I really hate to admit this, but I was like, you know, kind of ashamed that my parents maybe didn't even fit the mold of other people's parents necessarily. And they are immigrant parents. So, you know, my dad was working his ass off for us. Yeah. My mom was working her ass off for us. And they never talked about that. You know, like we could see they were struggling, but they would never let us necessarily know that. You know, they painted a really nice like picture for us and we're like, this is your childhood. We're going to make it so you guys can be kids, you know?
Yeah. But I think underneath some of that, and, you know, we can talk about this a little bit later, in some ways they were suffering. Yeah. And in also a lot of other ways, their relationship suffered. Perhaps because, you know, people, they didn't feel like it was okay to talk about the issues that were going on or bring, you know, the things that were coming up for them. And I think there's so many families that have these kind of similar stories. And again, like these almost like generational and cultural differences. And we've talked about this in other podcasts. Like I'm thinking, especially like with Carolina Gonzalez, that she, you know, her parents, her father's Guatemalan, her mother's Mexican, but she was like, but I was born in LA and I'm American, but of course I'm Latina. And, you know, just some of those like cultural values that didn't in some way like instilled so much and have given so much to her, but then have been like at total odds with kind of the American, you know, kind of individualism and, you know, like talking about things. And I, you know, it's just, I think creates like more layers of complexity for families. So we've set the stage, you know, so you are this, you know, Chinese American family living in this like very lily white suburb. And so there's already kind of that cultural and like racial, you know, issues that are going on. But more importantly, what I want to talk about was you were an athlete and this was something that you really got into because your father was an athlete. And this was a way for you to really try to create some connection between the two of you. And obviously like, these are your genetics, right? You've inherited these, you know, these great athletic, genetics and aptitude. And so you were involved in like a lot of activities. But especially you were involved in ballet.
Yeah.
How old were you when you first got involved in ballet?
I was 3. So I will give that, you know, props off to my mom because she was like, let's put them into everything when they're young. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my earlier ones along with swimming. So those two, she put me in at a real young age.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And, but you were, I mean, you were very serious about ballet. Like this was very important to you. You like were committed to ballet.
Yeah. That was like my, yes, that was my commitment. I would say through middle school. And then I kind of, you know, got to that point where I was like, oh, I don't know if I can do this anymore, if I want to do this anymore. And my mom's not the typical like Chinese tiger mom per se. And she's just kind of like, okay, well, I'm not going to like force you. Which, you know, side note, but I was like, oh, I kind of regret that. But, you know, I got back into it in high school, but I was very, very in love with ballet. Yeah. That was like my life as a child. So,
but this also created between you feeling kind of like an outsider and I think, you know, probably not understanding the depth of the trauma that you were experiencing as it relates to like the racial microaggressions that you came in contact with in Danville. So there's already that piece like, you know, brewing like, but you're not enough, you know, but you're not blonde, you're not white, you know. And then for anyone that understands ballet culture, and this is not a secret in ballet culture. I mean, ballet is all about being literally as thin as possible because you want to be as lithe as possible because obviously if you're doing complex moves, you are being lifted, spinning, twisted. And so anyone that looks at like prima ballerinas understands that they are very, very, very lean. And there is a pretty, I mean, I don't think I'm speaking in hyperbole. There's a pretty twisted culture in a lot of ballet companies about as it relates to food, eating disorders, and almost like anorexia, if I mean to be blunt.
Yeah.
And so both of these converged for you. And this created something that was really problematic. Do you kind of want to talk about that as a, you know, especially as you're kind of in like high school? And this, I feel like when we were talking earlier, that this was kind of where like the shit started really hitting the fan from like kind of both of these things, you know, kind of piling onto you and really, frankly, harming you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of it just, it kind of built up over time, obviously. And, you know, looking back at it now too, obviously we're going to talk about it a little later, but like just with the stress that I could see with my parents and their relationship kind of like crumbling. And then me moving to a totally new place and feeling like, yeah, I didn't belong, but I was trying to pretend, you know, all these different aspects of my life just kind of getting shuffled. I felt like I was losing a lot of control. And yes, in dance, in ballet, there's a lot of body dysmorphia. You're supposed to, quote unquote, supposed to look a certain way. And I would just, you know, constantly compare myself. I mean, I was still in elementary school. One of the first memories I have there is just like, you know, we're going to dance Swan Lake. And my bestie in there, she's this tall, you know, beautiful girl, but she's, you know, white and she's thin. And I just felt like a little stumpy, like that kid next to her, and we're both wearing the same tutu. So, you know, little thoughts like that started to play. And then I think really in high school, it was just like, I was feeling like a loss of control. And I think that's partially why that may have developed at that time. And it was right after high school, again, feeling like I wasn't cool enough. I needed to be, you know, one of the popular kids. I needed to look a certain way for people to accept me. And that was the only way that people would accept me. When, you know, speaking to people now, it's like, apparently I was accepted, but I didn't feel like that. So I really started, I don't think I mentioned this to you, but my boyfriend at the time, there was one specific incident I can remember where he said, "Oh, it looks like you've been drinking a lot of beer because you're kind of getting a little bit of a beer belly." And he like hit my stomach. And, you know, I wasn't fat back then. I was very fit. And I remember that moment, something clicked in my head, like, you need to do something about this. And it just kind of, it was a downward spiral from there. Tons of, you know, bulimia, anorexia, overexercising. It fueled me into college, started running, and used that as kind of a, you know, catalyst of, this is what I'm going to do, run, sleep, and not eat.
Yeah. I can't believe like you just shared that story because it's so interesting. I shared a similar story when Danielle interviewed me for my podcast episode. And I said, when I was like 15, this guy, I like met some guy at a football game and I thought he was, you know, like cute or really cool. Mm-hmm. And you know, we were like kissing or making out and he also like touched my stomach, which has always been like a very sensitive like area for me. Cause you and I have very different body structures.
General, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm like a really, you know, like I'm a very tall, like a, you know, white girl with like German roots and I'm quite curvy. And he was just like, he's like, are you kind of like fat there? And I literally, it, like Nikki, it's like this happened yesterday. And the amount of, you know, kind of like control and like gravity that I allowed this like ding dong, you know, to have on me, I was just like, what? Like, who are you? And like I said in my podcast episode, this is a guy like seriously that probably peaked when he was 16. I would not be surprised.
Yeah, I think I remembered listening to
it. Yeah, you know, I was just like, come on, like, who are you? And like, why am I allowing you to get in my head and somehow tell, you know, and I think just for so many women, like this is how we have been socialized to be. And especially depending on the specific activities that you engage in, your, you know, how you, your gender identification, your, you know, racial makeup, your socioeconomic makeup. I mean, it's just like these like toxic messages. And so, yeah, I mean, I know that, you know, it's like, we were talking, you're like, and I was like, whatever, I'm just going to like over-exercise. But then you added in like some other things of kind of like self-destructive behavior. You're like, I am going to, you know, like girls, like, you know, I'm supposed to put out like if people are going to like me. So let me, you know, let me do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and not necessarily because of – for my own choice and pleasure, which you absolutely can, but for the pleasure of men. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like you were like, hey, I know I need to like look a certain way for people to like me. So, you know, this kind of like the pinnacle of this, would you say, would be when you joined the cross-country team in college? And then didn't you say like your weight like drastically went down?
Yeah. So I had been starting right before that to like restrict. And then a lot of it, I think was like bulimia because I was drinking a lot. So then, you know, you'd like get the munchies and then like eat, and then I just throw it all up. And that didn't seem to be working that well. And so I used to run before cheerleading, in college, and the cross country coach approached me one time, and I was just warming up. Like, it wasn't anything crazy. And he's like, "You have a really great stride. You should join cross country." And I was like, "What? I hate running. Like, I just do this to warm up. Like, I played volleyball throughout high school. We did like sprints. That was my thing. I hated the mile, whatever." And I was thinking, okay, well, maybe I could actually lose more weight this way because runners are so thin. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, sure, I'll do it. And then I instantly was like, oh my God, after our first practice, I was like, what did I do? Super intense. We were running, you know, 50 plus miles a week, rain or shine. And at the same time, you know, I started really tracking everything that I was eating. Like, I had a diary. It was just like every single thing, which ended up becoming very minimal because I would literally have like frozen grapes and water and then, you know, run a ton of miles. I would run before races, which my coach told me not to do. And it was just like, it got to a point where I almost felt like I didn't have control anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think people who have an eating disorder can speak on this, that, you know, whatever you want to call the eating disorder, it has a life of its own. And, you know, we call her Anna, you know, Anna for anorexia. And it's just, you personify it almost, because it literally takes over. It's almost like the body, like, is not strong enough to fight it anymore. And I also think for me, it was partially like physical, emotional, mental, just complete exhaustion because I wasn't getting enough nutrition. I remember I was in a nutrition class, and it was like back in the day. So she had this like weird little thing that she would like, it would like measure your body fat. So like I went up, you know, to the front of the room, and I don't know why, like, was like, sure, I'll do this, you know. And she was like, she did it in front of the class and was just like, okay, well, you have this amount of body fat. And to me, I just really wanted to know how much body fat I had. And it was like, you know, not a lot. But at the time I thought, oh, okay, I can go even lower than that, you know? And it was like competing with myself. Yeah. So eventually it got to a point where, you know, my pediatrician, she had been my doctor, like obviously through my young adulthood as well. She spoke with my mom and said that she thought that I needed to get some help because I was like withering away. And so I got admitted to Lucile Packard at Stanford Hospital, in Palo Alto. It's, you know, an amazing program, but yeah.
And you were 19. You were 19 when you were admitted. Day.
Yeah. I was about 19. I just remember, you know, driving there with my mom, had a, you know, UCLA sweatshirt on, and drinking a Jamba Juice, which was like my, you know, only meal of the day, and thinking, you know, I don't know what I was thinking. I don't even know how I got convinced to go. I just was like, I didn't have any more energy to do anything. I didn't, at this point, Sarah, like, I did not want to live. Like, I did not want to wake up in the morning because it just meant I had to do everything all over again. And like, my body was just tired.
Yeah. Like all of the control, all of the exercise.
All of it. Yeah. And everything, like my behavior changed too. Everything had to be very organized and neat and like, yeah, crazy. At the hospital, you know, it's a program where you're on bed rest until your heart rate and your vitals get to a certain point, and then you can graduate from a liquid diet. So I was just drinking a ton of Ensure and Boost, getting weighed every morning, back facing the scale, vitals taken every hour, everything monitored in my sleep. And I actually had one of the evenings I had a heart murmur. So I had like some irregular heartbeats. So that's why I had to be on bed rest for longer, no showers in case of hypothermia. When I did graduate to solid foods, you know, you had a very specific diet. You had to fill every single piece of this pyramid and make sure you're getting all of your nutrition. But to me, it was just like, okay, I'm getting added calories, you know, and we're all being monitored too by people because they don't want us throwing it up. They don't want us like chucking the food over our shoulder or putting it in a pocket. So it was just this very controlled environment, sterile. We're in a hospital. And I'm meeting other people that are quote unquote like me, but I just felt like I didn't belong there almost because I wasn't as skinny as them. I was like, well, they're like way skinnier than I am, you know? But then on the other hand, I kind of felt like I saw it for what it was because, you know, a lot of these these people were kids. You know, there were some very young children in that program, and it was sad. It was alarming to me. I was like, what? There's no way, you know? And when we got talking, it was like we could relate on so many things, but at the same time, we were kind of in this like false sense of reality of like denial that we had an eating disorder, you know? Yeah. It was like camp in a weird way. Yeah.
And you had a boyfriend at the time. And he was not kind about.
Kind of boyfriend.
Yeah. He was so not kind. Yeah. What happened with
him? Yeah. So total, like, you know, obviously these like things last with us forever. And I think it was, I was already traumatized initially with him because, you know, I lost my virginity to him. He knew I was virgin. I was Christian, you know, at the time, and thought, oh, I'm probably going to wait until I'm married to have sex. And that didn't happen. We got really drunk and I thought, okay, sure. And come to find out that he actually was dating somebody that I played volleyball with. So not only was he not a virgin, he had a girlfriend, and it was just so traumatic to me. But I stayed in that. And he, you know, him and I, quote unquote, stayed together, even though he went off to college in Boulder. And then, you know, I stayed. And we did talk sometimes. And one of the conversations we did have while I was in the hospital was, you know, I spoke with my sister and she said that I probably shouldn't be with somebody like you, or I shouldn't be involved with somebody like you. And that was just like, you know, heart crushing to me. Yeah. Because I just wanted this, you know, I wanted him to accept me and love me and this and that, when all the while, like, he would make comments about, you know, clearly he was sleeping with other people there. So it wasn't, you know, whatever this quote unquote relationship was, it was not that. But I just wanted so much to, again, be accepted by somebody, you know. Of course, he's this white guy, you know, kind of popular, whatever, at the time, you know. So
you get treated at Lucile Packard, you're 19. How long were you in inpatient treatment for?
I would say I was there for, gosh, it's so long ago. I can barely remember. It was definitely like at least maybe a month or three weeks to like a month.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So not too long. Yeah, I did speak with one of the girls there who actually, she had a huge impact on me. I think I'll remember her forever, but she told me, and some of the people there told me, that they didn't know if she would ever actually be able to leave, because she'd leave a lot and then have to come back because she'd relapse. So yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things. It could be like you bounce out and then you try not to come back, but then, you know, it's expected sometimes. Yeah.
Do you know off the top of your head, and if you don't have this data, it's fine, we can search for it later, what is the relapse rate for people that are experiencing anorexia? I think it's pretty high. Like, meaning like
it's high.
You're anorexic, you know, like you're diagnosed, you go into treatment, but it's not, for most people, it's not just one time of treatment that's going to be effective. And for many people, treatment is never effective.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Because it comes from something deeper, obviously. And so it's something that, like, I think stays with a lot of people. I think they can relate with that. I know for me, it definitely does. And sometimes, like, when I'm really stressed out or whatever, like, my thoughts kind of move back into that space. I think it's just, you know, working through other things. And I think sometimes the focus can be more just on the eating disorder itself, when actually there's a lot of things behind it that, you know, are really affecting it.
Yeah. I looked it up while you were talking. And so according to the National Institute of Health in the United States, relapse is common among recovered anorexia nervosa patients, and studies on relapse prevention with an average follow-up period of 18 months found that relapse rates were between 35 and 41%. That's a lot. And that happened to you because you found yourself, and this is kind of like, you know, when we talked, you're like, this was like kind of my epiphany. You're like, it was New Year's Eve. I was 20 years old and I was in the emergency room, and you were in the emergency room because of anorexia. And also part of, you know, something that I thought was really interesting when we talked about this initially too, was this whole idea that also the hospital was like a nurturing, safe place where you got attention and you were cared for. Mm-hmm. And so it felt nice to be there. Mm-hmm. But you were like walking down a hallway and you caught a glimpse of yourself in the mirror. And just kind of like walk us through what that experience was like and kind of the, you know, realization that you had.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is obviously after like my first treatment at the hospital, and this was just the emergency room, like, I don't know, in San Ramon or Danville. And my pediatrician had, you know, come to visit me, and she basically said, you know, obviously in the kindest way possible, that she's like, you know, I don't know if there's anything else like I or anyone else can do at this point. Like, you really have to, you know, make a decision for yourself. And I think those words just really struck me. And I had to go to the restroom. So I got up, you know, I had my IV hooked in. So I was like dragging along my little bag. And then I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror. And, you know, I just, you know, I had my gown on, I had my, you know, IV in my, my bag there. And I just looked at myself and I was like, whoa, I all of a sudden just kind of saw myself, I think, for what maybe other people saw me as, because constantly I would just see this really like fat girl in the mirror. But at that point I saw, you know, my skin color was weird. My face was really gaunt. My arms were gaunt. Like all I could see was like, wow, I'm actually very thin. I've never been this thin. Like, I don't know if this is such a good thing. And, you know, call it God or higher being, but I just felt this, like, I heard this voice say like, you know, if you don't make a change, you're not going to get through this. You're not going to live. And I knew that in my heart, that was true, because if it wasn't the eating disorder that would kill me, it would be myself, because I, you know, obviously I was suicidal at the time too. So, it would have been either or.
So then what were you able to do to really kind of change the trajectory for yourself after that emergency room visit when you were 20?
So obviously it was a very slow process, and I still relapsed after that, because, you know, it was a big weight gain. So my weight fluctuated. Then it was like, okay, well, let me stop trying to think about all this weight that I'm gaining by drinking a lot or, you know, doing drugs or just throwing everything up. So then it mm-hmm. shifted to like a lot of bulimia. And so it was, I hate that I had to go through it, but I had to go through these ups and downs to really find my middle ground. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of a sudden just create a different relationship with my body, with food, nutrition, and all of that, because I think it was just, I used it as, you know, either a comfort or I used it to like push things away. And just, you know, getting into a lot of therapy and figuring out like the root of things is kind of how I started to, you know, move in a different direction, because I was like, this is a pattern and these are habits, and I need to change something in order for me to improve, get better, and find some sort of a light at the end of the tunnel type of thing.
When you were in therapy, working with your therapist, what did you kind of identify as the, mm-hmm. kind of the roots of where this all started?
Yeah. And so I think that's been definitely a challenge too with therapy. I've been to so many different therapists, and obviously like I went through a lot of therapy, you know, while I was in the hospital and such. And I never felt like they even understood me. And, you know, thinking back too, it's like, we didn't really address a lot of the things about, you know, maybe necessarily like traumas that I had or how I felt as like, you know, a Chinese American in an affluent, you know, white, suburban home. So I think,
Oh no, it's okay. I mean, the reason I talked about this is, there's multiple reasons. You haven't had the benefit that is, I think maybe even some like our younger generation of women have now to really understand the complexities of childhood trauma, and especially trauma as a result of racism, trauma as a result of sexism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I have someone that has had many relationships with many different therapists too. And I think it's always, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you've done this too, like, you know, when you meet therapists that you can like game the system, right? And you can kind of like tell them what they think that they want to hear. Yeah. And then they're going to tell you back what they think, you know, that you need to hear. Yeah. And all the while you're kind of like, but I'm not actually like being totally honest with you. And I don't know if you had like some of those therapeutic experiences. But the reason I was asking in that is just what I want the listeners to understand is all of these, you know, like these eating disorders, the suicidal ideation, and then also for you, what happened at age 30 was a diagnosis of bipolar 2 disorder. They're so, you know, complex, multifaceted, just because that's who we are as humans. And I think if you only just kind of approach, you know, dealing with, you know, disorders like anorexia or even bulimia, just like, well, just eat more or just stop, you know, overeating, that's, you know, that's never, it's never the root. That's always just a, you know, symptom of larger issues. And, you know, I think fundamentally what I see with you is this larger issue of like enoughness, you know, like nothing, I'm never enough. It's like, it's never, I'm never skinny enough. I'm never, you know, pretty enough. I'm never, you know, like white enough. And the enoughness, both looking at the way that men perceive you and then also enoughness, I think looking at how like your family perceives you. And those are so very different things. And again, like culturally complex. And that is really, that's really difficult to unwrap. I think it's really difficult to kind of sift through. And I really like that you said that you're like, hey, this like recovery from anorexia, it wasn't like I had this epiphany when I was 20 in the hospital and like the next day, I just, I'd made a change.
It's still and growing.
Right. And like miraculously, like now I am living my best life. Like that's not how life works. And especially, you know, from a behavior analytic perspective, we understand when we have long reinforcement histories and learning histories, it takes a long time to shift those. But I want to talk really fast about your diagnosis with bipolar 2 disorder, because in some level, like this was like very freeing for you to be able to finally have this diagnosis. Why?
Because so most of, you know, most of my life, like I guess after my eating disorder, it was, you know, I was diagnosed with depression and anxiety, which seems like, okay, that seems about right. I have taken like every medication under the sun. So if I went to a new psychiatrist and she'd say, oh, have you tried? I'm like, yes, I've tried them all. And I would get frustrated. I throw them down the toilet and like all this stuff because I just felt like nothing was working. And so finally, when I was diagnosed with bipolar 2 disorder, well, first off, I like freaked out because I was like, bipolar, but that means I'm crazy, or people are going to think I'm crazy. Am I crazy? Oh my gosh. Like, cause you're thinking, I'm thinking, you know, this person that's just like loose cannon, like ups and downs. And then I was like, well, I mean, I guess sometimes I can be like that. But the difference with bipolar 2 disorder is you are in a heavy, you can go very low. You're in a very like depressive state. Your highs are not like manic highs, like a bipolar 1. And obviously there's nothing wrong with either, but I think, you know, what my psychiatrist told me was that, you know, bipolar 1 is more prevalent in you know, younger people. And then it can shift into bipolar 2 as you get older. That's just how it is. And so I thought about that and I was like, I'm not sure if that's necessarily what I was experiencing when I was younger, but I could see sometimes a little bit of the manic highs and then many of the depressed lows, low lows. And so when I was, you know, now I'm being treated for that, which is a mood disorder. And it's, you know, my medication is working on a different piece of my brain. And so that's why I feel like that is actually helping. And that's why my psychiatrist explained, that's why, you know, my medication hadn't been working in the past because it wasn't treating for a mood disorder. Wrong part of the brain.
Yeah. But then through, you know, the recovery from anorexia and then through the bipolar 2 disorder, what you have been able to do and what are you really you're currently doing is instead of using exercise as this like punishment and honestly like an, you know, a form of self-hate, you really have, you know, chosen to use exercise and specifically running and yoga as a way to care for and love yourself. And so can you talk a little bit about why, especially the practice of yoga has become so important in your life?
Yeah. Well, first off, I mean, I'm an introvert and I think sometimes it's hard for me to find community because I'm an introvert, But since, you know, fitness has always been a comfort of mine, I feel like my walls can kind of come down. And so I think also within yoga, that is clearly, you know, you find a community, you find these people that, you know, have a similar mindset or, you know, similar goals per se, or, you know, they're searching for the same thing, whatever. And I just found that with the practice, what it stands for, you know, meditation, mind, body, everything about it is just something that can, it can calm the mind. It can lead to more productivity. It can create a safe space for you. And although you're doing it with other people, you're also in your own space. So it's like, it's just security that I feel. And I can almost compare it to dancing. I hate public speaking. I don't like speaking in front of people, but I loved, and I haven't done it in a while, but I loved dancing because you could, you know, really express yourself with your body, but you don't have to say anything and you don't really pay attention to the people around you because you're kind of in your own little world. And I feel the same with yoga a lot of the times. I personally love to practice with music and it kind of brings me back to that space. So, and I love doing it outdoors, which is why I like running. The outdoors is something that also uplifts me and I feel like is very much my medication that, you know, is outside of Western medication. That's
yeah. Well, and you know that I've been obsessed with this book lately called Lost Connections by Johann Hari. Like this is, I read it. I gifted
it
to myself.
I'm waiting for it in the mail.
Yeah, I know. You're like, I ordered it, girl. I gifted it to myself for Christmas. And so I wrapped it in my own stocking. And of course, you know, I opened that in and Jay's like, oh, who got you that? I'm like, Jay, who do you think got me that? By myself. This is a gift from myself to myself. But part of what Johann Hari talks about is the whole idea that for so many people, especially in like Western culture, we have really lost these connections with moving our bodies and understanding that we are part of this like massive natural world and that those are actually, you know, two reasons why people feel so, you know, disconnected, you know, depressed and anxious. And that's why when we were at For Defy really kind of thinking about like what types of different, you know, like member benefits, for lack of a better term, do we think will be really important to our community to allow people to come in contact with connection as much as possible in all types of ways that's really rooted in science and that there's a scientific framework for understanding the importance of this. And yoga really made sense to us. And I think it's also nice because yoga is like anybody can practice yoga. Like I love, you know, like it's like yoga is for everybody. Yoga is for everybody. There is so many different types of modifications. If you have a disability, you can do yoga. If you, you know, have like muscle issues or like tendon tightness and or people like me who, you know, really cannot stretch in the same way in our mid-40s that we could, and you can still do yoga. Like yoga is for everyone. Yeah. And I love how you, you know, kind of talked about, you know, the practice of yoga and the practice of, you know, running outside makes you come in contact with the dancing that you loved when you were younger and just almost getting lost in the experience and in the, you know, the art and the music and the sound and this just, it's this incredible transformative thing. And I do want to give you a massive shout out because I do know that you're an introvert. And when we like did the podcast prep for this, you're like, oh my God, even like last night I was like texting you. I was like, hey girl, we're recording your podcast tomorrow. Are you excited? And you were like, no. You're like, I'm very nervous. I'm very nervous about this podcast. But you've done so great. But this is also – but I also think sometimes like – I think it's even sometimes hard for introverts to find like where do you have your place, right? People like me are loud. And so loud people sometimes get more attention. But that doesn't mean that we should. And that doesn't mean that there's not space for people that are – walk with more of a softness. And that's something that I love about you is you walk more with the softness, but also, and I don't know if you realize this about yourself, there is this like power in you. And I remember like the first time I met you, I was like, I like her. Also, you like fashion and so do I. So I was like, this bitch is my bitch. I was like, you're wearing Gucci. I have a Gucci. Like, we were like automatically friends, right? I was like, yes, yes, and yes. But yeah, but there is just this like inner... And we love dogs. We like Gucci and we love dogs. But there was this like inner, this inner, you know, strength and power that emanates from you. And I can also see, especially when you were teaching yoga, because I've, you know, like listened and watched you before, especially because like Jay likes to teach your yoga class. He's probably going to try to like, you know, secretly come into our Defy Yoga. I'm like, you are not invited, Jay. Yeah. This is not your space. But the, you know, you're, it's just so, it's like such a natural place for you. And I think it's just like such a calm place for you. And I think that that is really awesome. And then that allows people to then come into that practice with you and then also, you know, be able to like, you know, see you as an example of this, this calmness and, you know, you're at peace, but then also like, especially when you're doing like harder stuff, like, but it's a workout and everyone's stoked about it. So I'm just really, I'm really excited to, you know, have the community have these experiences. But the one thing that I know that we had talked about, and I want to make really clear, we're not trying to say that like you have all your shit figured out. Cause you don't, and I don't either, you know, and the things that we do in order to maintain our mental health and to maintain our wellness and to, you know, deal with our own issues of enoughness, like it's a, these are daily, it's daily struggles. And I love that you've been so honest about that. And I think that that also really allows people to then come to your yoga practice and kind of come just as you are, like, and that's okay. And it might be a hard day. And that's okay. Or it might be a great day. And that's okay. And we celebrate you and we celebrate everyone in the place that they are and we meet them where they are. And your practice for that day is what you can do based on who you are and how you are that day. And that's fine. And that's what I'm hoping that we can provide for the community. And also, frankly, something that I hope that you can provide for yourself more often. That you're enough.
I'm excited. I mean, I have such a passion for it. And I love, you know, seeing that kind of light that I've felt like in other people. And definitely, you know, like you said, just it's something that we do to maintain and help ourselves feel sane and move us through each day, no matter, you know, where we are in our life. And I do want to mention too that I did go into yoga as well because as a runner, I would have like chronic pain all the time. And so I just want to mention that because I know, you know, people are sitting at their desks, like, you know, or they're maybe they're like a hardcore athlete and they're not doing yoga. They're feeling these like chronic pains. And I will say after I did it, you know, for a good solid, you know, however many months regularly, I didn't have any more pain. And if anyone who knows me, they know this, that I'm always like, I'm hurting, this hurts, I'm in pain. And then all of a sudden, even Manny was like, you haven't talked about hurting, anything hurting in a while. I was like, it's yoga.
So we welcome everyone to get their yoga on and please. Come as you are. And that's Wednesdays at 6 a.m. Pacific Standard Time and Saturdays at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Because let's be honest, it's Saturday. We don't want to have to work out at 6 a.m. We want to get a couple hours of sleep. And I'm, you know, I'm really grateful for your willingness to bring your introverted self onto this very, very public platform in order for people to kind of understand you better and to understand, you know, why they might want to approach, you know, starting a yoga practice and especially within our community. So thanks, girl.
Of course. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Defy. We really appreciate your support and we hope that you listen to all of the different podcasts that we've put together. And guess what? We're available on all of the podcast platforms and on social media too. And we even have a website. Like seriously, we have all of that stuff. You can find us at www.defy.community. You can find us on Instagram at defy.comm, on Facebook using the same defy.comm, or you can even send me an email if you just want to chat about something or if you have an idea of a podcast that you think would be really great for our community. Our email is contact@defy.community. We hope that you have found something that you can take away from this podcast that will impact your life. We hope that you continue to defy society's expectations of you because remember, baby, well-behaved women rarely make history.